I'm Carl Gerke. This is Jazz Nightly on SDPB Radio. I'm joined now by bassist, trombonist, and composer Chris Brubeck. He's the son of Dave Brubeck. And on the occasion of his dad's centennial, the Brubeck family has just released a collection of outtakes from the Dave Brubeck Quartet's classic 1959 album, Time Out. Chris, welcome to Jazz Nightly.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Carl.
Now, outtakes from famous jazz albums have been released through the years. How come the Time Out outtakes have not been available until now?
Well, actually, it's kind of a simple reason. I didn't know that they existed, nor did anyone else in our family. But because it's my father's centennial was coming up, since December 6th, 2020 would be the 100th year since he was born in 1920, two people wrote books about my dad. And in their research, they had access to archives. And in the archives, they notified us, hey, did you guys know that there are actually alternate takes to Time Out that exist? They're pretty good. You guys might want to check them out. So that was like a couple of years ago that we heard that the fact that they existed at all. And then while we're out on tour in England, we do an annual tour. My brother Darius, the oldest of us, is a pianist, and he lives in England. My brother Dan, the drummer, lives outside of Vancouver in Canada, and I live in outside of New York in Connecticut. And we get together with an English saxophone player, and we had a day off. We started listening to this stuff. We said, wow, this is not just takes, and it's a good thing that they didn't use it because they're no good. These are actually great takes. Maybe these are better than what went on Time Out for various reasons. So we're really intrigued. And thus, we started a process of thoroughly investigating this music and putting it together and finding the best aspects of what was there over four sessions over three different days, spaced 3 weeks apart. And we came up with what we think is just an outstanding record.
Now, this album came out in 1959, recorded in 1959. The Dave Brubeck Quartet, your dad's band, was already one of the most popular groups in jazz at the time. But this album brought a whole new level of success to the quartet. What was so special about Time Out?
It's one of the few times in art where originality, purity of vision, trying to blaze new trails and not cater to someone's idea of what success would mean, actually all came together and paid off. Since I'm of a younger generation, you know, my dad was obviously a successful jazz musician, which is almost an oxymoron. You know, it's like you got to love the music, and not many people make a really good living at it. But I know as a kid, when Jimi Hendrix came along, I was like, wow, this reminds me of my dad. Not musically, but in terms of someone who was so different from what was going on and really had a vision. He created this thing. I don't think Jimi Hendrix did what he did because he's going, wow, what? This is really commercial. Everyone's going to love my music. You know, it was because he was doing what he felt in his bones that he needed to do as a musician. And then a following was created around his vision. And that's what happened to my dad.
One of the fascinating things about this album is, as you mentioned, this is experimental. But yet at the same time, it resonated with the popular listening audience, and that this was a big success at the time and continues to be one of the most popular, biggest-selling jazz albums of all time. And that seems to be something that's kind of rare, at least in the world of jazz. So do you think that's kind of the key to what makes this album so special, is that your dad and the other musicians were just following where the music took them?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, and there's actual reasons why the music was taking them into this direction of odd time signatures. And it really goes back to the year before, in 1958, the Dave Brubeck Quartet took part in a program that the Eisenhower administration was running. And it really had more to do with Adam Clayton Powell, congressman from New York. But the idea that jazz embodied the democratic ideals of America. And there was a program called The Voice of America. It was like, you know, now we have the internet, and that's the famous, you know, line is, you know, even communist China, I don't know if it's true or not, you know, they can't stop the free flow of information because of the internet. Well, in those days, the equivalent was The Voice of America, which was broadcasting radio signals that would go across the Iron Curtain. So if you were in occupied countries like Poland or Hungary, you could actually hear news from Western sources instead of propaganda, communist propaganda. And you could hear things that they liked to play, like American jazz. And there was a huge following. So to make a long story short, in 58, Dave went out under the State Department guidance and toured a lot of the Iron Curtain countries, and then went into crazy places like Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan. As a matter of fact, my oldest brother Darius and Michael were on tour with my mom, and the State Department sent them home saying, we can't guarantee the safety of anyone. There were so many revolutions and warlords and people riding around, doing crazy things, very unstable. But when they got to Istanbul, they heard street musicians playing in a crazy beat, which my dad had never heard before, and he realized, he figured it out, it was a 9/8 time. And he went to the State Department had set up a situation where he was going to meet local musicians, and they knew who Dave was. And he told them, I heard this crazy beat on the street. What is that? And they started laughing. They said, oh, my God, in Turkish music, that's so common. That's like the blues in America. So that comment spurred the fact that Blue Run Alaturk has a big blues in the middle and alternates with blues going back and forth from 9/8 to 4/4. So that was the first piece that was like, wow, this is fun to play in odd time signatures. It grew out of that 58 tour. And then the idea of doing an album that explored odd time signatures was basically the roots of Time Out.
Mentioned Blue Rondo a la Turk, one of the popular tracks from the original album Time Out, and we get to compare the master take, which was recorded in August, the one that we hear on the album, and then this June 25th, 1959 alternate take. The ensemble part, the theme is together, but the solos are completely different. Paul Desmond, the alto saxophonist, is playing a different solo. Your dad has more choruses. How do you compare what they were doing in June to what came out on the official album in August?
Well, personally, as a jazz musician and a composer, I like the newly discovered version better because you're always trying to integrate music. As a composer, I'm trying to find either secret ways or obvious ways of tying opening themes into other structures as I develop a piece. And in fact, even if people don't notice it, it sort of secretly makes a piece seem more unified. And in this case, you can hear, most people know that, for example, the melody is da 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 da, and then the blues, Dave at one point goes da 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 da, he's taking what we call a musical cell and displacing it. And so instead of the blues having nothing to do with the previous melody, it actually ties in beautifully architecturally. In a very kind of strange tonal way, which I think he was thinking of some of the crazy sort of Middle Eastern horns he probably heard. He was definitely thinking more about that than Charlie Parker when he played his solo. And I think they did that, and probably, I don't know for a fact, but I would imagine their producer said, hey, and you can hear him announce it. They don't know the tune. He didn't know the tune. He goes, this thing, Turkish. He called it Turkish. He probably said, hey, that's too long. You should do a shorter version of it. And that doesn't mean that it wasn't any worse or any better. It just meant it was long. And, those days it was hard to get more than 18 minutes aside. And maybe he was just afraid, can you do a shorter version of that? So to me, it was fantastic to to discover a version where Dave actually explored and played 10 choruses on it instead of, I think, 4 on the more famous Time Out version. And you can also hear, if you listen with headphones, you can hear him kind of grunting as he's playing along. I mean, I know my dad's playing. I've been in his band for at least 30 years to know that when he's really in the groove, he's sort of grunting along while he's playing. And so that's part of the fun of that piece. It's just to, everyone was on the edge. They didn't know it that well. Sometimes when you don't quite know something and you just play it well enough to get through it, that's when it's really, really exciting. And listeners can kind of feel that unidentifiable energy that's in a performance that's just coming together. It's an exciting thing to hear and to witness live, especially.
The most famous tune from the Time Out album was written by Paul Desmond, Take 5, and the alternate take that we hear on this new release, I think, is just fascinating. The master take was made about a week later, the tune that the version that we all know so well. But on this album, you can hear that the band is still working it out. Paul Desmond is still working on the melody a little bit. And
yeah.
Joe Morello, the drummer, is playing a completely different beat.
Yes, that was really a surprise to us, because the beat that Joe played on the famous version of Take 5, in a way, if you asked 100 drummers, how would you play a beat in 5/4, even if they'd never played one before? And most of them would probably have gone, jing, 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 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which is what he did on the famous version. On this version, his beat was so complicated and so dislocated and syncopated that there's a little track on there at the end of the record called Band Banter, and you can hear that Joe actually can't even remember how to coordinate his limbs so he can play this crazy beat he came up with. And you can hear the band, you know, sort of waiting on him to get it together. Paul Desmond goes, hey, I need some coffee down here, you know, Joe, can you work that out, you know? And, you know, Joe was a supremely technical drummer, so I had actually never even heard a situation where Joe just didn't know exactly what he was doing and was on top of it. But it was fascinating. What you hear is one of the few complete takes that happened on the very first day they tried to record that, which was the first of the recording sessions that took place over 3 days over about a period of a month. They were each isolated. And they spent about 45 minutes, and then finally my dad says, hey, you know, I think maybe we should just come back to this. And then Tio said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's come back to this. And to me, it's just beautifully ironic, because they come back to it, and then they, you know, they record it, and it becomes this worldwide phenomena hit. But at that point, they were just trying to create something to be a vehicle for a drum solo. Of course, they had no idea it was about to become this hugely popular tune.
And on the released version, your dad is playing the vamp. Eugene Wright is playing a bass pattern underneath Joe Morello's drum solo. And his solo is more subtle. On this version, the outtake, they lay out, and it's a little more aggressive in the solo.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as someone that grew up watching Joe Morello from the wings, I was just always amazed, because he was such an incredible drummer. And you could feel the audience just get totally, you know, hypnotized by what he was going to do, what he was about to do. And remember, they wanted it to be a drum feature. One thing I heard from listening to all the takes is my dad's famous vamp, boom, chunk, chunk, boom, boom, chunk, chunk, boom, boom. That really was something that he started playing just to help Gene and Joe keep the five together. It was like the sonic glue he invented to keep it going. And I think they just sort of felt like, huh, we've got to give Joe a solo, and maybe if we try to keep that going, we'll screw him up more than we're going to help him. So just stop playing and let him go. And then, you know, maybe hearing tapes over the next couple weeks, they got it more into their head what they wanted to do when they come back and they cut that version.
And that vamp, I think, is one of the things that really captures listeners' ears and probably had a lot to do with the popularity of that recording.
Yes, I think it's really true. I mean, for listeners, too, it was a challenge. Like I don't know how many people heard that and thought, oh, I'm going to try to count five when I'm listening to that. But if they did, hearing my dad play that vamp, it was certainly the thing that they could hang on to like a little life vest as they enjoyed. And then Joe had a totally different approach to his solo. You know, when he had that riff behind him, he left a lot more space. And, you know, there's different people that can argue that his famous drum solo from the original is quote-unquote more memorable or better. It was more unique because he left so much space in his solo. On the other hand, Joe's such a great drummer. I think it's a thrill just to hear him go out there and let it all hang out on that tune.
I'm Carl Gerke. This is Jazz Nightly on SDPB Radio. My guest is Chris Brubeck. He's the son of Dave Brubeck, whose centennial is December 6th. And the Brubeck family has just released a collection of outtakes from the Dave Brubeck Quartet's most popular and famous album, Time Out, recorded in 1959. And Chris, the other tracks on this album that are the alternate takes, Strange Meadow Lark and Three to Get Ready and Kathy's Waltz, those sound to me like, well, there are a few differences, but really the band sounds like they have those pretty much down already.
Well, you know, it's interesting. They're such fine musicians that I don't know how much they rehearsed those before they walked into the studio. But on Strange Meadow Lark, for example, when we listened to all the different tapes that were rolling, Dave played a beautiful, beautiful intro. And then Paul came in and got lost and blew it. And they had to stop the take. And this is a case where, you know, with the 60 years of hindsight, I heard references to my dad saying, oh, man, I wish we could have used that take where I played such a beautiful intro. And then I'm like, well, there's this modern thing called splicing, even though they did it back then, too. But, okay, so we did use Dave's most favorite intro, and then we found a different take where on the bridge where Paul comes in and he starts playing his solo. We used that, and that was so it was two different takes married together. And, of course, later on they recorded Strange Meadow Lark, and it was also a beautiful take that went on that recording. But in this way we got the best of Dave's piano work from his opinion at the time, and for me listening to it all, I agree with him. And then I think that Paul's solo, the part that we used on a different take, is so beautiful. I think is even more beautiful than what's on Time Out in that example.
What does hearing these outtakes help us understand about how the Dave Brubeck Quartet worked and how they created music?
Well, Boy, it's kind of interesting. Like, to me, it's a thrilling experience. And, of course, I have a very warped and unique perspective because as a little kid, it's really true that I used to crawl under the piano and listen to that group rehearse. It was a wonderful place to listen to the music, and also it was a safe place. I couldn't be in anyone's way if I was under the piano. No one was about to step on me. And I would get to see Joe Morell's bass drum and hear Gene Wright's bass. And I mean, they were all such fantastic musicians, and they all worked so well together. My dad gave everyone a lot of freedom to do what they were good at doing. And that combination of those four musicians, I mean, I was a kid that grew up like seventh grade or eighth grade for me is when the Beatles hit. And, you know, in a way they were like the Beatles of jazz. And I don't mean, you know, musically, but just they had distinct personalities. And the way they all came together was just perfect chemistry. Like, for example, I would say Gene Wright, who he's my godfather, and he's still alive. He's in his mid-90s. And there were other bass players who were more technically oriented than Gene. Like, you know, for a famous bass player would be like Charlie Mingus, or Scott LaFaro was a young guy playing with Bill Evans. And the bass was becoming more of a soloistic instrument. And Gene was coming out of the school of having played with Count Basie. But that's what that group needed. Just like you could have said, what would the Beatles have been like if Ginger Baker were the drummer instead of Ringo Starr? You know, each guy brought what was needed to that group, and they completely meshed together just in a perfect way.
Yeah, that's always been my impression of this quartet. When these four musicians came together, just magic was made. And, of course, the partnership between your dad and Paul Desmond, that goes back to, I guess, from what I understand, they first met during World War II, but it was, I think they started working closely together around 1950, 1951 or so, and they have one of the all-time great partnerships in all of jazz history. Two very different people. Your dad was a family man, Paul Desmond, a single guy, and had more of a jazz lifestyle, I guess. But what was it that made this partnership work so well?
I don't really know, but I must say that there were times in that partnership, and I don't know quite all the different reasons, but there were times when my father had just had it with Paul and didn't really want to work with him anymore. And my mom was the one that kept saying, you got to give him another chance. There's something about you two when you're together. It's just magically wonderful. And she was the peacekeeper. It's interesting. You're right that Paul did lead more of the jazz life, you know, like to stay up late at night. You know, he liked to drink and hang out with his friends. And my dad was like, I got to get home. You know, I've got five kids at home or six kids at home at different times in life. And, you know, everyone, let's go hang out. No, I'm working on a new piece. I'm going to compose it right. You know, he just didn't fit into that whole jazz scenario. But I know that my mother really loved the brain and the talent that was in Paul. And he really loved the brains and talent of my mom, who not only was a wonderful mother, but she actually sort of turned the jazz world upside down in her own way by being the person, believe it or not, no one had thought of, like, why doesn't a great jazz group play at colleges concerts instead of smoky nightclubs where, you know, she was sick of her husband coming home and smelling like an ashtray at 3 a.m. Hey, this music deserves to be heard. Why should it get treated with the respect of classical music? So she really got a hold of every college on the West Coast and said, you should have my husband's group play up there. And some of Dave's early records are Jazz Goes to College, Jazz Goes to Junior in College. So she's one of the unsung heroes of really changing the shape of the jazz industry. ¶¶
I think your dad is recognized as one of the finest composers in jazz, leader of one of the most popular and influential bands, but as a piano player, it seems like he's often overlooked and I think even dismissed by critics, but to my ears anyway, he has a distinctive style and an approach that doesn't really seem to really fit in any particular school, or like bop or cool. How would you evaluate your dad's playing?
Well, I think that's an interesting and fair comment, and I would say that my dad's playing was pretty original. It was interesting, after the Ken Burns Big Jazz documentary series, you know, the 13-part series that was on PBS, there was like a national movement of people reassessing my father, you know, sort of Dave outlived many of his critics, literally. And then there were younger people, and they were going like, why did we overlook this guy? Because if you just were completely objective about it, he is as out of the mainstream and original as Monk or someone. You know, if you really can clean yourself of all the preconceptions, how he played was very different. And my father always said that he was a composer that played piano. And he would go for different approaches at night, and you could hear his brain thinking and composing while he was playing. I know from playing thousands of gigs with them around the world, he always played well. There were some nights where he was in the zone. He was like magically well. It's like the equivalent of Michael Jordan maybe could score 84 points on one particular night because he was just, you know, in the amazing zone. But also, Dave used to have a faster single note way of playing, and then he had a bad diving accident and broke his back and broke his neck, and that slowed him down a little bit, so that sort of turned him more toward a block chord player. And then some of his favorite composers, like Stravinsky, sort of had these big block chord approach harmonically to what they wanted to do. On the other hand, my father had tremendous appreciation for Art Tatum, who had maybe the most blazing technique of any jazz pianist ever. And, you know, he admired all the great pianists, and it was very odd as he got older, instead of playing his own tunes that he made famous, he just really enjoyed playing old songs that he heard when he was a kid and playing things that reminded him of Fats Waller and different great players that he had heard of and had known. I think it's sort of maybe a given thing for anyone, you know, if their parents live long enough, they get more and more sentimental, and you just start diving into the music that helped shape you as a kid. But my dad was an inventive player, and he came up with a lot of things that are stylistically very interesting, and, you know, you can really trace it back to things that he did.
December 6th is the centennial of your dad's birth, as we mentioned, born 1920 in California. In the broader picture, we're just talking about his piano playing, but how do you see your dad's legacy, and how do you think people will still relate to his music in years to come?
Well, I hope that they do. It's really hard to predict that. I mean, here we are, we still listen to Mozart and Beethoven, and people are like, what, you're comparing your dad to that? I'm just saying the longevity of a style can mean something for a long time, and I think it will. You know, the fact that my dad's father was a rough-and-tumble cowboy, but his mother was a pianist, rubbed off on him, and so even though he always really liked classical music and ended up writing a lot of classical music, many people seem to think that Dave is someone like in the ilk of Andre Previn. Like, for example, Andre Previn is an accomplished classical piano player that learned how to play jazz. But Dave wasn't like that. He had dyslexia as a kid. He was a great ear player, but he was not a great classical pianist. And it's true that he studied with the famous French composer Darius Milhaud after World War II, but he really taught himself how to read and write music backwards by composing music. It's a very slow motion thing, composing. He gradually got his reading together. And he still wouldn't be the kind of guy that would say, hey, let's sit down and play a Bach invention. In fact, when he'd write something new, he'd often ask me to come over and we'd play four-handed piano and just sort of work our way through the score. And I'm not a great pianist either, but between our four hands, we could basically, you know, give him a good idea of what the piece sounded like. And then eventually we started composing together because I had gotten used to using the program Finale, where you could enter the music into a computer and it would play it back for you, so you'd have a mock-up of what an orchestra would sound like. And he thought that was the greatest invention in the world. He didn't want to invest in learning the technology, but he sure enjoyed coming with me. He said, in the old days, we could never hear what it sounded like until it was a dress rehearsal, and then it was too late to fix anything.
The Time Outtakes album, is this the first in a series of planned albums by the new label put out by your family, Brubeck Editions?
Yes, it is. And we keep running into situations where, for example, someone in Australia had a father that died, and then he was going through his father's closet and then said, oh, yeah, that's right, my dad was a radio engineer. Oh, hey, this is interesting. It's a tape. You know, the Dave Brubeck Quartet, 1962 in Melbourne? Huh, I wonder if this is any good. And then they hear it and they go like, hey, I think it is really good. And then they figure out how to find us and they send it to us. And we're going like, wow, that's cool. What a discovery. So there's different discoveries that come our way. What we hope to do is to put out records, I would say, hopefully at a pace of one a year, something like that, that is our family's, you know, filter of finding music that the public's never heard before that we think is really good. I mean, in Europe, there are tons and tons of, like, bootleg pirate records that come out. And, you know, there could be someone had a little button microphone in the lapel of their coat, and then they tape it and they put it out and they hope they can sell 500 copies or whatever, you know. And it's not always the best sound or the best music, but my brothers and I, having recorded and played many concerts with my dad, you know, we have a very high bar of what a really good performance is, and we know what to look for, and that's what we want to keep presenting to the public over the coming years.
And you probably have a good idea of what your dad would want people to hear, that maybe there's some things he would have preferred that didn't get out to the public.
Oh, yeah. You know, I play with him enough so that I knew what kind of music, when he'd walk off the stage feeling like, you know, he felt really happy about something. I know organically, you know, having shared the stage with him so much, you know, what those special moments are. And you can just hear it. I mean, I hear it in other groups, too. In jazz, it's so beautiful. I think that one of the things that people that like seeing jazz live, and if you hear a live recording, that they love so much, is this very unique feeling of you are seeing something literally being created on the stage, and you're hearing the chemistry of one musician reacting to another, and it's working its way up, you know, kind of climaxing into some sort of great musical tension that has a release, and then it goes into the next chorus. And I've seen it time and time again where the audience feels that. And you don't get that exact thing from classical music. If the composer is super good, he has, you know, his way of presenting tensions in the music that resolve, and the audience feels that too. But that's slightly different than everyone reading the page and going into what the composer intended, than this feeling of you're seeing it created right on stage. And it's really an exciting feeling that can't be duplicated in any other kind of music.
I know the pandemic probably put a damper on some planned concerts and celebrations for your dad's centennial. Are there still things in the works? Maybe the band that you have with your brothers doing some concerts, that sort of thing?
Well, you're right. I mean, it put that's the understatement of the year. I mean, we lost 100 concerts from the pandemic because all around the world there were going to be great celebrations. My dad's 100th, you know, from the Hollywood Bowl to the Royal Albert Hall, Monterey Jazz Festival, New Orleans Heritage Festival, you know, all that kind of thing. And, you know, understandably, it just couldn't happen. We were lucky in that at the Jazz Education Network in January, before COVID hit, we were able to play and present an organization, a family foundation called Brubeck Living Legacy, where we're going to try to help keep Dave's music alive and help others that want to do that and make different kind of partnerships. So that's an exciting thing. Of course, has been kind of dampened in this first year, and starting a music camp called Brubeck Jazz Summit in Tahoe, which also had to get canceled. And then we worked on the beautiful big floating jazz festival cruise around the Caribbean. That was terrific. I was commissioned to write a new piece for orchestra and chorus and singers and jazz group in the style of one of my mom and dad's religious pieces. So I did that. And then before all that, even, I had what I thought was a good idea, and I wrote an orchestral suite called the Time Out Suite, with the idea being the orchestras all over the country, whether they hired a jazz group or not, could salute Dave's music through this medley that I was creating. And I'm happy to say that the world premiere is going to be played in performance today. So that makes me feel really good, because they have a huge listenership. And if the point of being a composer is to get the music outside of your head, and in this case, the arrangement I came up with of my dad's music into the ears of, you know, literally more than a million people, that makes me feel like, well, that was accomplished, and I'm hoping my dad will look down from up above and say, all right, you did something right. That worked. We fooled everyone. Despite COVID, you got that done. So that's where we are right now.
Well, Chris Brubeck, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Jazz Nightly. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for taking the time to listen. And I just got to say very sincerely, it was thrilling for everyone in our family to discover this music, and we've worked really hard to get it out into your ears, and I hope that you and your listeners will find this to be as a rewarding a musical journey as we have. And we're getting lots of great reactions, so it's wonderful to know that I'm not completely self-delusional. This music does speak to people.